Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Before I start on the sutta discussion, I just want to make an announcement. Sharon has lost her copy of the middle-length discourses. If anybody has seen a copy, it looks like this. It's not a small book, so... But if anybody has happened to see a copy with, it has your name in Chinese characters on it.
Right. And I have a book cover, green cover.
It has a different cover.
Yes, it's
oh.
Yes. It's green color.
And then a white carrying bag. If anybody has seen that, then please inform her. Okay, so now we continue with the... We're in the Satipatthana Sutta. This is Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 10. And we are in the section on contemplation of phenomena, Dhammanupassana. And we come to... the section on the seven factors of enlightenment. This is page 153, starting with paragraph 42. Okay, so now, just to recapitulate a little, the section on contemplation of phenomena, Dhammanupassana, begins with the section on the five hindrances. And now, in the framework of the Buddha's teaching, there's a kind of direct opposition between the five hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. So in many suttas, in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the collection on the enlightenment factors, one sees the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors are constantly opposed to one another. So it's said that the five hindrances are the five main obstacles to the development of the mind. And the seven factors of enlightenment, those are the most important factors that lead to the liberation of the mind. So in my understanding, in the section on Dhammanupassana, contemplation of phenomena, the real main contrast here is between the five hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. The five hindrances are the factors that have to be overcome to be eliminated, and the seven factors of enlightenment, those are the main factors, the main qualities that have to be developed, that have to be matured, that have to be brought to perfection. Okay, but contemplation of phenomena is also concerned with the development of wisdom, panya. And so panya means seeing and knowing things as they really are. And what are the things to be seen and to be known? We have three categories. come within that fit that description. Three classes of things here. One are the five aggregates. Another are the six internal and external sense bases, making 12 bases altogether. And the last is the Four Noble Truths. But the knowledge or the wisdom that knows the Four Noble Truths, that comes only after the seven factors of enlightenment have been fully matured. Is it shot or? Okay. Okay, now the aggregates, the five aggregates. Maybe enough, because it's getting to be a little distracting for me. The five aggregates and the six internal and external sense bases. Once the five hindrances are overcome, these are the things that appear within the sphere of contemplation. So when the mind becomes freed from the five hindrances, becomes well focused, well concentrated, then one can direct that concentrated mind to explore and to investigate the field of living experience. And as one is investigating, exploring the field of experience, one uses these particular schemes as ways of organizing the totality of experience and seeing experience in terms of the categories of the Dhamma, to see experience in terms of these basic structures, which serve as the supports for the maturing of panya, of wisdom. And so with wisdom, one explores the five aggregates. With wisdom, not only the five aggregates, but their arising and passing away. Again, with wisdom, with insight, one explores the six sense bases. And one also, the six internal sense bases, that is the sense faculties, and their respective objects, and also the fetter that arises dependent upon both. Okay, and as this exploration, investigation begins to gain momentum, to pick up speed, or to pick up power, then the seven factors of enlightenment become prominent. Actually, these seven qualities can be present even in earlier phases of the practice, but now they start to come together as a unity, you could say, as a team of factors working together, pushing towards the end, the goal of enlightenment. And so that is why this particular set, the seven enlightenment factors, come at this particular point in the sutta. Okay, and so we have the text. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu, a monk, abides contemplating, here I change the translation, phenomena as phenomena in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. And how does he do so? Okay, here, there being the mindfulness enlightenment factor in him, a bhikkhu understands, there is the mindfulness enlightenment factor in me, or there being no mindfulness enlightenment factor in him. He understands there is no mindfulness enlightenment factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness enlightenment factor, and how the arisen mindfulness enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment by development. Then this is the same pattern is repeated for the investigation of phenomena, of investigation of states or investigation of phenomena, enlightenment factor, then the energy or vigor enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the concentration factor, and the equanimity enlightenment factor. So in the case of each one, when that factor is present, he understands this factor is present. When it isn't present, he understands it isn't present. He understands how this particular factor arises while it is yet unarisen. And after it arises, he understands how it comes to fulfillment by development. Okay, everybody should have a copy of the chart on the seven factors of enlightenment. Here I pulled together material from a number of suttas and commentaries. Which help us to understand these seven factors of enlightenment. Okay, so the mindfulness enlightenment factor is described in the suttas. In one place it's explained, interestingly, after a monk learns a particular teaching, it said that one recollects that Dhamma and thinks it over. And here the verb recollects anusarati. This verb is related to the noun sati. You could see from the stem form of the verb sarati. That gives us the noun sati. So recollecting, remembering is related to mindfulness. And here it's a little puzzling, I have to say, and unusual to think that sati as mindfulness is connected to remembering or recollection. But in Indian languages, in ordinary speech, the word sati or Sanskrit smriti means memory. And the Buddha took this word from ordinary speech and gave it the special meaning so that here one is remembering not the past, but one is remembering to be aware of the present. Or one is calling to mind the present, recollecting the present. But more typically, it would be said that in explaining how mindfulness functions, it said simply that unmuddled mindfulness is established in him. So this mindfulness means, you could say, awareness of things that are occurring in the present as they are occurring. That's the sense in which mindfulness functions as an exercise in meditation. And now mindfulness has already, the practitioner has already started to develop mindfulness from the very time of beginning the practice of satipatthana. So we can say that the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is first coming into being only when one reaches the stage of the very end, almost the end of contemplation of dhammas. But even when one is beginning, say, the first exercises in mindfulness of breathing, or contemplate, or observation of feeling, or observation of mind, in any of the exercises, the key factor to begin with is the arousing to bring up this mindfulness. And for the practice to succeed, one has to be constantly monitoring the presence or absence of this mindfulness. When one is keeping the object in mind, when one is mindful of the object, continuously mindful, then of course one should from time to time reconfirm that one is mindful of the object. That is understanding that mindfulness is present in me. And when the mind slips away from the object, when it gets lost in distracting thoughts, then one has to bring to mind, or recollect the mind, catch the mind as it's running away, and bring it back. Then one is recollecting or noting that this factor of mindfulness is not present and has to bring it back. At this point, perhaps we wouldn't say that mindfulness is not, we would have to say that mindfulness has not yet really become an enlightenment factor, but this is, even these initial exercises in mindfulness, these are the seeds out of which the enlightenment factor of mindfulness will grow. And one also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness enlightenment factor. To understand this, one has to understand what is the principal condition for this particular enlightenment factor. And the answer that we have in the suttas is giving careful attention to things that are a basis for the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. And what are those things? Basically, anybody tell me in a nutshell? I'll give you a hint. Four things. What are these things that are a basis for the enlightenment factor of mindfulness? Hint is that there are four of them. Yeah, four foundations of mindfulness. Okay, so giving careful attention to the body in any of the exercises for the body, feelings, states of mind, or phenomena. And the commentaries give a number of other conditions. I don't think I'll be able to get all of them in. To discuss them all, but I'll just go through a little quickly. It mentions having mindfulness and clear comprehension, which is almost redundant. I think the idea is that when one has clear comprehension of what one is doing in one's day-to-day activities, that will bring mindfulness along with it, so that one can be mindful in one's meditation. Then one should avoid persons who are with muddled and confused minds, associate with mindful people, and have a suitable inclination. That means have the inclination towards developing mindfulness. Okay, as the mind becomes established in mindfulness, or as mindfulness becomes established in the mind, then one becomes able to distinguish more and more precisely, more and more clearly, what is taking place in the mind. And one becomes more and more sensitive to the particular qualities of the mental states. And then, at this point, one starts to look into these mental states as they are arising and to distinguish them, to discriminate amongst them, to see what has to be restrained and overcome, and what has to be encouraged and stimulated and strengthened. This is the initial stage of investigation of phenomena. In the suttas, it is explained simply, he discriminates that Dhamma, that is this Dhamma that he is observing with mindfulness. He discriminates that Dhamma with wisdom, examines it, investigates it. And then the suttas explaining what is the principal condition for investigation of phenomena say it is giving careful attention to wholesome and unwholesome states, that's states of mind, blameless and faulty states, to bright and dark states. These are really all synonyms. So, what I would call the initial stage of investigation of phenomena is this ability to distinguish between the wholesome and unwholesome states of mind. And this ability, this capacity for discrimination, forms an important step for further development of the mind. And as the mind develops further, investigation of phenomena will take on a deeper function. It will turn into that factor which will examine phenomena in terms of their real characteristics, which will be able to discriminate, to distinguish what are the particular characteristics of phenomena, what are the characteristics of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, volitional formations, consciousness. And then it will investigate the general or universal characteristics of phenomena, the characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha or suffering, unsatisfactoriness, and the characteristic of anatta, selflessness, non-self. But now we're taking the enlightenment factors in sequence, so as one discriminates between these wholesome, unwholesome states, one restrains and overcomes the unwholesome states, one is strengthening the wholesome states, and as one strengthens the wholesome states, then the mind becomes charged with more and more energy, so that sometimes it seems like one is tapping into previously unsuspected sources of energy, because the mind is becoming very pure and clear, and that gives access to deep sources of spiritual energy which now become very active. And so it's said in explaining the energy enlightenment factor, his energy is aroused without slackening. Oh, but I should go just quickly through the other conditions for the investigation of phenomena. Okay, the inquiring into the aggregates, that study about the aggregates, personal cleanliness, having a clean body, clean clothes, clean facilities, since that will facilitate the clean or clear functioning of the mind, balancing the spiritual faculties, deep reflection, and then associating with wise people and having that inclination towards wisdom, towards deep understanding. Okay, so these are conditions which bring the unarisen enlightenment factor of investigation, which bring it into being, and as one goes on cultivating these conditions, they will bring that factor of investigation to full development. Okay, now energy arises, this very powerful energy. And what is the condition for the arising of this energy? The sutta says, giving careful attention to the three elements of energy. These are called dhatus, elements of energy. What are these three elements? One is the element of arousal. This is the first stage when one is arousing energy. The second is called the element of endeavor. This is where one is persisting in one's effort. The energy is now picked up momentum and it's now continuing steadily. It's now continuing steadily. And then the third stage of energy, I translate it rather freely, the element of unstoppable advance, unstoppable progress, where the energy is really just very intense, burning very strongly. This is the stage sometimes spoken of in the text where a meditator can sit for 3 hours at a stretch without any problem, can sit through, maybe needs only 3 hours of sleep a night, because the energy is now very, very, very intense. You can just read the list of the other conditions for the arising of energy. I won't stop to explain them. Okay, when energy starts to pick up strength, when one discovers this mind is now becoming focused, steady, and this energy is arising, the mind is experiencing great purity, and so this rapture arises, one starts to feel a joy and happiness that one has never experienced in any of the so-called pleasures of worldly life. So it's said now that spiritual rapture arises in him. Said the principal condition for the arising of rapture is giving careful attention to things that are a basis for the enlightenment factor of rapture. But I think the main factor that brings this rapture into being is this force of energy arisen through growing, increasing mindfulness and the power of investigation. But to strengthen the rapture, from time to time, one can do such things as recollection of the three jewels, that is, the recollection of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, or recollection as one has pure moral practice, one can recollect the purity of one's moral practice, or give attention to reflect upon the fact that one has now entered upon this path to complete liberation. Reflections like this will strengthen the factor of rapture. Okay, now rapture in itself, when it comes up, naturally it's a very joyful experience. but it has a certain edge or element, ingredient of excitement to it. It's sometimes bubbling with excitement. The mind is a state of exhilaration, the mind very, very happy, very joyful. And that is a disturbance. At first, it's very pleasant. The mind is carried away. One has never experienced such states of happiness and bliss before. But that ecstasy, that exhilaration, is a state of excitement, agitation, a very subtle agitation. And so one has to prevent oneself from becoming attached to that rapture and joy, but goes on just observing one's objects with mindfulness. One has to note even that rapture with mindfulness and let it go, let it go, let it go. And as one lets go of the rapture, just attending mindfully to one's principal object of meditation, the rapture settles down and the mind becomes tranquil. The text says the body becomes tranquil. Of course, that rapture is a state which also, it seems, to pervade the body. So the body is also excited. The mind is excited. But when one lets the rapture go and keeps the mind just steadily focused on the main object, the breathing, could be the rise and fall of the abdomen, focusing upon any of the five aggregates one might be observing, or just observing the impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, selflessness, whatever. The body becomes tranquil and the mind becomes tranquil. Okay, the sutta gives us the principal condition for tranquility, giving careful attention to tranquility of body and tranquility of mind, which I have to say doesn't really explain very much to me. But what I would say is the principal condition for moving from rapture to tranquility is not becoming carried away by the rapture, not becoming attached to it, letting it go, and bringing the mind back to the main object of meditation, and just to continue observing the main object. As one goes on observing the main object, one enters into this state of tranquility, and from tranquility, then the mind becomes filled with something called sukha. Sukha is happiness or pleasure. This is something different from rapture. Happiness or pleasure is a very quiet, very calm type of happiness or joy. It's not the excited, rapturous, ecstatic happiness of piti. This is very quiet, tranquil, peaceful type of happiness. It's like a cool breeze in the late spring. And in that frame of mind, the mind can settle down even more steadily upon its object and remain consistently, continuously upon that object without wavering, without losing the object, remains focused upon the object, and by settling upon the object, it enters into samadhi, concentration. And so for one whose body is tranquil and who is happy, the mind is concentrated, or the mind becomes concentrated. And the principal condition for the arising of concentration is giving careful attention to what is called the samatha nimitta. That's the sign of serenity, or also called the sign of non-dispersion. This is the subtle object of meditation, of concentration that arises. As one's concentration becomes better, stronger and stronger, then there arises this subtle inner object, kind of could be a light, inwardly perceived light. And so one just steadies the mind upon that inwardly perceived object, and the mind becomes completely absorbed in that object, and that becomes concentration, samadhi. Then some other conditions mentioned by the commentaries, again, balancing the spiritual faculties, skill in meditation, so that one knows how to apply the appropriate remedy for the particular fault in the meditation. If the mind is too excited, one knows how to calm it down. If the mind is too inert, one knows how to stimulate it or to arouse it. If the mind is a little dejected or discouraged, one knows how to encourage it. Then the others should be quite obvious from what was said already. Okay, and then as the concentration deepens, then a factor that has been present all along in the development of the meditation becomes more and more prominent, and this is equanimity, upekkha. This is the quality of simply looking on from a kind of standpoint of detachment, looking on, observing whatever is happening without being carried away to the left, to the right. The text says, as concentration matures, he closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated. In the earlier stages, one has to look at the mind, whether it's excited, if it's a little excited, one has to calm it down. If it's a little sluggish, one has to push it ahead. If it's a little discouraged, one has to encourage it. If it's a little dejected, one has to uplift it with joy. But now, when all of these other faults have been overcome, one looks at the mind and one just looks on with equanimity. It's like one is riding a horse. To get the horse started, one has to maybe hit it from the back. Then it starts riding. If it's going too fast, one has to pull it by the reins to make it go a little slower. But now the horse is galloping at a steady pace, and one just sits in the saddle, sort of looking at the countryside around one. One doesn't have any more concern with what the horse is doing. And it's said that this factor of equanimity arises from giving careful attention to things that are a basis for the enlightenment factor of equanimity. Again, this isn't elaborated any further in the suttas, and I think one has to use reflection to draw out the implications, but I take it that the best way to understand it is simply that by bringing all of the, by overcoming all of the faults in the concentrated mind, all of the little minor faults in, of the concentrated mind, then the mind becomes perfectly concentrated, and then equanimity reaches its pinnacle. Okay, this is all explained, the way I've explained it now, as though one is developing the enlightenment factors from the standpoint of, we call, serenity or samatha, gaining concentration. But these factors are enlightenment factors. They are factors which are directed towards the attainment of enlightenment, which means that they also function, and that I would say that they especially function, in the framework of developing insight or vipassana. So even if one is not developing samadhi or concentration to the level of the deep jhanas, but when the mind reaches a certain level of samadhi or concentration, one can then use that concentrated mind to investigate phenomena, the aggregates, the sense faces, in terms of the three characteristics: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. And as one does so, these same seven factors of enlightenment will also be operative. They will also be functioning, because one is observing, one is aware of these phenomena, these impermanent phenomena. The awareness of them, that is being done with mindfulness. One is examining them, looking deeply into them, that examination, that deep inspection of them, or close inspection, and deep seeing into the nature of things, that is investigation of phenomena. As the mind with mindfulness, as the mind is investigating things, backed by mindfulness, it is also being powered by energy. And as there is energy, that will bring along rapture. That rapture again has to subside and give way to tranquility. And at a certain point within this process of examination, of seeing, deeply seeing, the mind is steadily concentrated. It's not the concentration of absorption with just one object. The objects are always changing because one is observing phenomena as they occur moment by moment. But the mind is fixed steadily upon whatever is occurring moment after moment after moment, so that even at the micro level, microscopic level, one is observing steadily this constant process of phenomena arising and breaking up and passing away. Arising, breaking up, and passing away. And while one is observing phenomena with this concentrated mind, the mind is simply standing back in this post of observation, which is characterized by equanimity. It's not being attracted to the phenomena, not attaching to them. It's not being repelled by them, not being pushed away by them, but simply observing with equanimity. I'm going to move into the next section, because what I've just said now just moves, say, seamlessly into the next section. Then I'll ask for questions at the end. Okay, now this observation with insight into the impermanent, unsatisfactory, selfless nature of phenomena is already that takes place when these seven factors of enlightenment have now come to maturity, come to strength. That is already the beginning of the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths. And with the Four Noble Truths now, the contemplation of phenomena, this fourth section of the Satipatthana Sutta, now comes to its climax, to its culmination. And the way I understand Dhammanupassana, I said, my interpretation is contemplating Dhammas as phenomena in terms of the categories of the Dhamma, of the Buddha's teaching, in order to penetrate the Dhamma as the truth of the Buddha's teaching. And now the penetration of the Dhamma as the truth of the Buddha's teaching is what takes place in the section on the Four Noble Truths. Should I say that again? Okay, this section is called Dhammanupassana, contemplation of phenomena. What does that mean? There are many interpretations. This is my interpretation. If you reject it, it's okay. It doesn't matter. There might be other interpretations. But okay, Dhammas, phenomena. So, Dhammanupassana is the contemplation of phenomena in terms of the categories of the Dhamma as the Buddha's teaching, in order to penetrate the Dhamma as the truth of the Buddha's teaching. And this penetration of the Dhamma as the truth of the Buddha's teaching is what takes place in this last section on the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so he's contemplating now, when he's contemplating with insight, the phenomena of the five aggregates or the six sense bases as impermanent, dukkha, suffering, non-self. And in this process of contemplation, the seven factors of enlightenment are all active now. They're all operating. And so observing this three characteristics in the five aggregates, the six sense bases, one is already contemplating the first noble truth. So one is understanding as it actually is, to some extent, I would say, to some extent one is understanding as it actually is, this is suffering. And then one can also see with direct experience, one could see how through craving, when craving arises, how this craving brings along suffering. One could see when there's less craving, how suffering diminishes. One could see this as a matter of immediate experience. And so one is having some understanding of the second noble truth, and one has a kind of inferential understanding of the third noble truth. One has not really penetrated it yet. And one knows that this path one is practicing, that this is, one has at least some sense that this is bringing an end to suffering. One has not yet actually really penetrated or fully understood yet or directly understood the Four Noble Truths, but one is gaining insight into the Four Noble Truths. The contemplation now goes, takes the three characteristics through deeper and deeper levels. And now we're taking a disciple who has fully mature faculties until when one really comes to what we call the bottom of the three characteristics, where the three characteristics all, in a sense, come together as one, then the mind, that very point where the three characteristics come together as one, is the door that leads from the conditioned world to the unconditioned realm, to the from the realm of birth and death to the deathless, from samsara to nirvana. To Nibbana. And so when the insight contemplation comes to the very bottom of the three characteristics, then the mind breaks through that door. That's a door locked with seven seals. Those are the seals that have been kept keeping us in samsara through beginningless time. Just momentarily it breaks through that door and comes out into the realm of the unconditioned. Just for a peek into the unconditioned, then falls back. But when it does so, it sees and understands this is the cessation of suffering. And then when it comes back into the conditioned, it looks back at the five aggregates, the six sense bases, 18 elements, conditioned origination, and knows this is really dukkha. This is suffering. It looks at this whole chain of conditions from ignorance through craving and knows this indeed is the origin of suffering. And it knows this Noble Eightfold Path is indeed the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And so one has now made that first breakthrough to the unconditioned, and as one develops that repeatedly, this process, in time it will come to the full realization of the unconditioned. And so that breakthrough to the unconditioned, that is the direct knowledge, the full knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. And that is, you say, the culmination of the Satipatthana contemplation. Okay, then we come to the refrain. In this way, he dwells contemplating phenomena internally, externally, both. And so on. That is how, a monk, a bhikkhu abides contemplating phenomena in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Then to conclude, the Buddha has, we call this the guarantee or statement of promise. Bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness or these four establishments of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, as if he should develop them diligently as explained in the sutta, then one of two fruits can be expected for him. Either final knowledge here and now, final knowledge, that's anya, that is the knowledge of liberation, the attainment of complete nibbana, final liberation or arhantship, right here and now. Or if there is some trace, some residue of clinging left, then he becomes an anagami, a non-returner. That's one of the third stage of realization. So in a way the Buddha is promising here either the fourth or the third fruits of the path, not even the second or the first. But 7 years that the Buddha is giving is sort of the maximum time. Then he says, let alone 7 years, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in this way for 6 years, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 year, one of the same two fruits can be expected. But even 1 year is too long. There are disciples with sharper faculties. They might develop the four foundations of mindfulness for 7 seems to be an auspicious number, so 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4, 3, 2 months, 1 month, even half a month, one of two fruits might be expected. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. But for some disciples, really sharp faculties, 2 weeks is too much. So if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 7 days, one of two fruits can be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. The commentary says that even 7 days is stated just for convenience, but it quotes another sutta which says that sometimes a disciple might be instructed in the morning and he'll achieve realization in the evening, or if he's given instruction in the evening, he achieves realization by the morning. Then there are some disciples with very, very sharp faculties. As soon as they get the instruction, they reach attainment right on the spot. But anyway, the Satipatthana Sutta ends with 7 days, 1 week. And then the Buddha says, so, summing up, he says, so it was with reference to this that it was said, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. And that is the end of the Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, at this point, I say I ended right at the spot, right at 8 o'clock. If there's any questions?
You mentioned something, and then you said I didn't catch it, about seven seals
seven sails.
Keeping his trappings. I didn't know what that seven referred to.
I don't know why I picked the number seven out. It was just arbitrary. It sounds like it's supposed to be seven sails.
Breaking through to realizing.
Yeah.
Something.
Aren't there supposed to be seven sails on the door to heaven, something like that?
So it's literary, right?
Yeah, I wasn't making a doctrinal reference. One might say the seven latent tendencies. Then I thought, as I was speaking, I thought, I could have mentioned the ten fetters, but then I would have had to say that he breaks through three, but then if there are seven fetters remaining, how could he get through the door? Then I would have had to develop the metaphor, and I hadn't worked it out in my mind. It occurred to me right on the spot. Yeah, if there are other questions.
I have a question. It was just noting how this list of seven factors, I know you mentioned how it differs from jhanic meditation, but there are certain striking similarities.
Yeah.
Rapture turns into tranquility and looks like the second or third.
Yeah.
Even when we're at the concentration,
yeah.
The enlightened factor comes to full maturity, that's still not the same thing as jhana concentration. And you're saying that's because you don't have one object in mind, you just have whatever objects come to you.
It's an interesting point, and it struck me many times that the sequence seems to have some parallels to the jhana, even moving from concentration to equanimity, from samadhi to upeka. You could almost take it to be the movement from first jhana or even second jhana. Second jhana is sometimes said to be an eminent state of samadhi to fourth jhana. In the fourth jhana, upeka, equanimity, is prominent. But I have never seen the suttas make that parallel. And the fact that these are called seven factors of enlightenment, to my mind, connects them with insight meditation more than with jhana meditation. But also concentration, samadhi, is said to have as its principal condition, giving careful attention to, this is the Pali, is samatha nimitta, the sign of samatha, and samatha is the process of meditation that leads to jhana. And so that again connects it with the jhanic type of meditation.
That acts of concentration and that
yeah. So it's possible you could see the seven factors of enlightenment is applicable to both. But I would see the seven factors as coming into their true light in connection with insight meditation. Yeah, Janet.
At the beginning of the seven enlightenment factors discussion, you were talking about how they were stated in some suttas as being in direct opposition to the five characteristics.
Yeah.
And then later you mentioned that once the five hindrances are overcome,
yeah,
that's the only way to get into studying or focusing on the other bit. But beyond that reference,
is there
any other connection that I should have been looking for between the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors?
I'm not quite sure that I understand the point.
I guess, when I see a thing as being opposite to each other, I imagine that I could draw a parallel between them. This is negative, that's positive. But in this case, it seems to be that you can't get to that until you've first gotten through those five things.
Wait, yeah. I would not quite put it that way. Okay, just for the case of the recordings, just repeat the question, best I understand it. She's asking, whether it's the case that one cannot get to the seven enlightened factors until one has completely overcome the five hindrances. Is that?
I think that's, I guess, my question.
I might be at fault for perhaps oversimplifying the explanation, because in the course of the process of contemplation, the five hindrances can still come up again. Even when one is, say, practicing the seven factors of enlightenment, one might be, in fact, this is something that happens to quite a number of meditators. One gets into the stage of piti. Piti has the sense of rapture or joy, and that joy gets connected with, at a very subtle level of the mind, is connected with sensuality. And so it tends to bring up, one easily slips from the rapture experience of rapture as an enlightenment factor, or rapture as a meditative experience, into sensual thoughts arising and then to sensuality. So then the hindrances are the work of Mara. So they have a way of slipping in whenever they get an opportunity. So if one is not very diligent and mindful through that arising of rapture, if one lets the mindfulness slip, then that rapturous experience can give an opportunity for sensual desire to arise. Or, again, say one might have very intense energy. Energy could easily bring up restlessness. If there's energy but not enough mindfulness to keep the mind focused, well focused, then the energy just can launch out on a trajectory of its own, and then it starts turning into restlessness. Or when one gets into tranquility or concentration, again, if there's not sufficient mindfulness, the mind sort of settles in quite comfortably to that tranquility, and before long, dullness sets in, dullness and drowsiness. Or maybe if one gets blocked at a certain stage in one's progress and can't go further, then, or some external disturbances come, one gets into a nice state of tranquility, then school lets out someplace in the neighborhood, children come running by making a lot of noise, and anger and ill will comes up. Or somebody turns on the radio across the street very loudly, or the dogs start barking, ill will comes up. So anyway, so these are illustrations that the five hindrances can come up within the process, even in stages of insight contemplation, tranquility, where one is in stages of serenity meditation, then one has to deal with them at that point. It's not just working in this very neat progressive sequence. Here are the five hindrances, overcome the five hindrances. Now it's going to be smooth going all the rest of the way.
Would you say that the strength of your development of the seven factors is in opposition to the weakness of the five hindrances?
Is the strength of the development of the seven enlightened factors... I would say that there tends to be such an inverse proportional relationship between the enlightenment factors and the five hindrances. So when the five hindrances are overcome, the enlightenment factors become stronger. But the five hindrances are very stubborn, and they could find an opportunity to come up again and take command. So maybe within particular, say, meditative session, if one overcomes the five hindrances, then the seven enlightenment factors will become predominant through the rest of that session, but in the course of one's development, in the course of a lifetime, one doesn't know. Any further questions? Okay, if there's no questions, then we will do the sharing of the merits. We share the merits with the devas, nagas, and other beings. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.